content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading today from the September 27th, 2013 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered, the search for Syria's chemical weapons, what happened. The clock began ticking on a chemical weapons handover in Syria this week after the Obama administration and Russia agreed to an ambitious plan that would strip the Syrian regime of its poison gas arsenal. Secretary of State John Kerry said Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad had 1 week to provide a comprehensive list of his chemical weapons, as well as the locations of the regime's storage, production, and research sites, and must allow international inspectors into the country by November. There can be no games, no room for avoidance, said Kerry. Under the deal, Assad's estimated stockpile of 1,100 tons of mustard, VX, and sarin gases have to be removed or destroyed by the middle of next year. Should diplomacy fail, said Kerry, the military option is still on the table. Russia, however, refused to let the United Nations threaten force. UN weapons inspectors released a report confirming that rockets loaded with sarin gas were used in last month's devastating attack on rebel-held neighborhoods in Damascus, killing more than 1,400 civilians. This is a war crime, said UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The report didn't name who was responsible for the attack, but did detail the trajectory of the poison artillery shells, which led back to Assad's stronghold in Mount Qaisun, where his army's powerful 4th Division and the Republican Guard protect his presidential palace and inner circle. What the editorial said. This deal will be difficult to enforce, but it serves America's strategic interest, said the Tampa Bay Times. The original aim of threatening Assad with airstrikes was to make the continued use of chemical weapons too costly to the Syrian regime. The agreement goes further by removing the arsenal entirely, and without entangling the U.S. in Syria's sectarian civil war. Only a fool would believe that Assad will honor his promises, said the Wall Street Journal. His military has spent the past few months hiding poison gas stocks at as many as 50 sites, precisely because it didn't want the West to track and destroy them. Our new partners in finding those sites, the Russians, have spent the past 2 years protecting Assad from international sanction and still insist he didn't use chemical weapons. And both Russia and Syria know Obama's unpopular threat to use force is hollow, since he won't take that political risk again. What the columnist said. Obama got to avoid a war he desperately did not want. But the real winner is Assad, said Shadi Hamid in TheAtlantic.com. Rather than being punished for gassing 1,400 of his own people to death, he's being rewarded for his war crime. The threat of military strikes has been removed, and America needs him in power to implement the agreement. Good luck finding and destroying all his chemical weapons, said Lewis McKenzie in the Globe and Mail. In 1997, the U.S. promised to destroy its own chemical weapons stockpile by 2007, but it's proved so difficult to transport and incinerate the toxins that the deadline has been pushed back to 2023. The idea that serious chemical armaments can be secured and eliminated in under a year stretches the imagination. Still, Assad will come out of this deal weaker than before, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. First, he has had to admit that he has chemical weapons, after strenuously denying it. Second, He has submitted to a deal struck by two outside powers. He can no longer present himself to his people, his enemies, or perhaps most fatefully to his military officers as a strong, independent ruler. Assad now looks like Russian President Vladimir Putin's lackey and Obama's manservant. Both Putin and Obama benefit from this deal, said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. Putin has emerged as a power player in the Middle East, while Obama is no longer compelled to launch military strikes that the American people clearly didn't support. The big losers are the Syrian people, who've suffered 100,000 casualties and will continue to be raped, tortured, and slaughtered in their homes. As long as they're not murdered with chemical weapons, no one will pay their deaths much mind at all. The second main story, Obamacare showdown. A shutdown of the federal government on October 1st appeared almost inevitable this week as the House Republican leadership struggled unsuccessfully to appease conservative lawmakers who insist they will not fund the government unless Democrats agree to delay or dismantle Obamacare. House Speaker John Boehner planned to pass a bill this week funding the government past October 1st, but cutting all allocations for Obamacare. That bill will almost certainly be rejected by the Senate's Democratic majority and sent back to the House. Unless conservatives then drop their drive to defund the law, or Boehner can pass a bill with Democrats that leaves Obamacare intact, the government will shut down. The GOP's leadership was offering conservatives an alternative, a bill trying to tying a debt ceiling increase to a one-year delay of Obamacare. The government will default if the debt ceiling isn't raised by the end of October. Obama said he would not submit to GOP attempts to extort a change in policy. It would fundamentally change how American government functions, Obama said. Both Democrats and Republicans want the shutdown to happen, said Noam Scheiber in NewRepublic.com. Obama and the Democrats are happy to let the GOP take the public blame for the pain that will come from halting federal government services, while Tea Party conservatives will be cheered for their defiance in their districts. Even Boehner may welcome a shutdown if the resulting public anger means he can start talking sense into his people. It's not too late for Republicans to turn back, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. When the national parks close and soldiers lose their pay, a wave of revulsion will crash over the GOP, taking away its leverage in future spending negotiations and damaging its electoral prospects in congressional elections in 2014. Kamikaze missions rarely turn out well, least of all for the pilots. Boehner is failing his party and the nation, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Instead of talking down the House's Tea Party crazies, Boehner is tantalizing them with more dangerous and less credible promise of a debt ceiling fight. Threatening to torpedo the U.S. economy to satisfy the Tea Party is not leadership, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. It's surrender. Controversy of the week. Putin. Has he outmaneuvered Obama? Russia is back, said Ariel Cohen in the National Interest. Thanks to an impressive bit of geopolitical judo, President Vladimir Putin has made Russia appear to be the equal of the U.S., despite its weak economy and diminished military. Putin recently stepped forward to broker the deal under which Syria's Bashar al-Assad will supposedly surrender his chemical weapons. That deal saved President Obama from the humiliation of having Congress reject his plea for a punitive military strike on Assad's regime. But it's Putin, a cunning former KGB operative, who most benefits. By making Obama and Assad partners in ridding Syria of chemical weapons, Putin guarantees that Assad Russia's client in the Middle East, stays in power. Most important of all, Putin has conveyed to the world that Russia is the great balancer of America, thus making himself far more powerful at home and abroad. Putin sure has some balls, said Julia Yaffe in NewRepublic.com. He followed up his triumph in Syria by running a smirking column in the New York Times in which he lectured Obama on international law and allied himself with the majority of Americans who are opposed to the military strike. In the struggle for influence over the new Middle East, there is only one man in the game who has a strategy, and it is not Obama. The game Putin's playing is larger than the Middle East, said Peter Beaumont in Guardian.co.uk. Putin knows that his fellow Russians still harbor a lingering nostalgia for the Cold War era, in which the Soviet Union was a feared superpower, holding sway over half the globe. Putin's goal is to regain at least some of that status. By beating the U.S. president at geopolitical chess, said Howard Schwaber in HuffingtonPost.com, Putin hopes to reestablish Russia as an economic and military hegemon, with a vast sphere of dominance extending from the Baltics all the way to Pakistan. And Putin just gave a very large global audience something to see: a Russian president telling an American president to back off and making it stick. Who cares who seems to be winning, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. As Niccolo Machiavelli himself once wrote, the player who appears to the most cunning and strategic is not always the one winning the game. If Putin's ego drives him to assume responsibility for the ghastly sectarian bloodbath in Syria, we should encourage him to take it. A year or so down the line, if Assad reneges on his promises, or his sarin and VX gases show up in terrorist attacks outside Syria, or Putin's diplomatic achievement results in even greater sectarian slaughter, the Botoxed former KGB hack will rightly be blamed. He hasn't played Obama. Obama has played him. Despite his macho bravado, what's really driving Putin is fear, said Michael Crowley in Time.com. For 3 years now, he's watched tyrant after tyrant on his Middle East doorstep get dragged from power by angry citizens backed by varying degrees of U.S. support. With growing unrest in Russia about Putin's own authoritarian excesses, he's clearly worried that America's regime change agenda has crept into his own country. That's why he's so eager to defend the sovereign rights of rogue states, and why he's trying to undermine Obama before Obama undermines him. It's not yet a second Cold War, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, but there's a new chill in the air, isn't there? Well, it was a good week for maturity. After 2,250 Americans were asked in a poll to pick an age at which they could live in good health forever, the average person's favorite age was 50. A good week for Solomonic decisions. After a judge in Spain ordered a divorcing couple to split their 2,700 square foot apartment down the middle to create two new homes. Because of the country's economic crisis, neither spouse could afford to buy a new property, so the judge called the division the lesser of two evils. And a good week for small print. After a Hawaiian woman persuaded authorities to redesign the state's official ID cards so her 35-letter surname could fit, authorities had previously suggested Janice, and I'll apologize here, folks. I cannot pronounce this name, but it does have 35 letters with a Hawaiian sound to it. But authorities suggested she use her birth name, Worth. It was a bad week for interventionism. after a Brazilian soccer team was booted from the playoffs because its masseur ran onto the field when the other team got a breakaway and blocked two potential goals. "I did it because of my love for the club," said the masseur. It was a bad week for selfies. After the Hong Kong Marathon announced it might ban cell phones from the event, because runners were causing bloody pileups when they stopped to take pictures of themselves. It was a bad week for Kohai Jino of Tokyo, whose home and business were demolished to make way for the 1964 Olympics, and who has now been told he must move again, because his new home is on the site of the 2020 Summer Games. "Deep inside, I have a kind of grudge against the Olympics," said Jino, age 79. We turn to the briefing section for a story about the Nation, spelled Q-A-T-A-R. And the author of this article informs us that the correct pronunciation for that is Qatar, as opposed to the commonly heard Qatar. "The tiny nation that roared. Qatar has used its petro riches to buy global clout. What does the emirate actually want? How rich is Qatar? The 250,000 native Qataris, are the world's richest people, with an average annual income of about $400,000. That's because the tiny Arab nation, a Connecticut-sized peninsula jutting out from Saudi Arabia into the Persian Gulf, sits on the world's third largest natural gas reserves. That resource has enabled pint-sized Qatar to employ 92% of its citizens in government-funded jobs, and to fund an outsized role in the world. Since 2011, the emirate has spent at least $17 billion supporting Arab Spring revolts and bankrolling Islamist groups across the Middle East. In Europe, the ruling Al Thani family has snapped up skyscrapers, soccer clubs, and banks. In the U.S., the country has given generously to the Brookings Institution, an influential think tank, including $2.5 million in 2012. Last month, the emirate launched Al Jazeera America, an offshoot of Qatar's international news network. Qatar wants to be the Arab world's next superpower, said Fawaz Gurgis, a Middle East expert at the London School of Economics. Has Qatar always been a global player? For most of its history, the emirate was an impoverished backwater, home to a few thousand pearl fishermen and nomadic tribesmen. The discovery of oil and gas in 1940 made locals rich, but it wasn't until 1995 when Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani deposed his father, Sheikh Khalifa, in a bloodless coup, that Qatar became a force in the region and beyond. While the old Sheikh avoided getting involved in international affairs out of fear of angering his larger, more powerful neighbors, Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait, another small, hydrocarbon-rich state, taught Hamad that keeping a low profile could be dangerous. "If you are going to be invaded," said David Roberts, a director at Britain's Royal United Services Institute, "you don't want people to go, Qatar. There's a country that begins with a Q? Where's that?" How did he raise Qatar's profile? First, he let the U.S. set up its regional military headquarters just outside the capital, Doha. Hamad then went about stitching Qatar tightly into the global economy. He built the world's largest facilities for condensing liquid natural gas, which the emirate now exports to Europe, Japan, and India. In 1996, Hamad launched Al Jazeera, a 24-hour news station that combined aggressive reporting, high production values, and an Islamic worldview. It really projected Qatar to a role of importance in the region, said William Yeomans, a media expert at George Washington University. Qatar now hopes Al Jazeera America will raise the Emirates' reputation in the U.S. It's really about enhancing Qatar's visibility, prestige, and influence, said Yeomans. Others, however, fear the channel will push hateful propaganda on American audiences. What kind of propaganda? The conservative media watchdog group, Accuracy in Media, says that the station's Arabic parent has given considerable airtime to extremists such as Yusuf al-Qaradawi, a Muslim cleric who has praised the killing of U.S. troops in Iraq. The group also points out that Qatar's history of backing radical Islamists. The Emirate gave $8 billion to Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood-led government, funnels cash and weapons to Islamist fighters in Syria, and last year handed $400 million to Hamas, the hardline Palestinian organization. But executives at Al Jazeera America, which employs some 800 journalists and staff in the U.S., most of them Americans, insist their programming is editorially independent of Doha. So far, the channel has focused on such topics as the hunger strike in California prisons and the impact of Chicago school closures, making Al Jazeera America look more like NPR with pictures than terror TV, said Lawrence Pintack, a media analyst at Washington State University. Does Qatar support radical Islam? Qatar is actually a relatively moderate Islamic state. Unlike in neighboring Saudi Arabia, women are allowed to drive, non-Muslims can buy alcohol, and young men and women often hold hands in public. Many Middle East experts say Qatar's rulers are pragmatist, not ideologues, and are trying to walk a very fine line between having influence in the West and cultivating favor in the Islamic world. When the Arab Spring broke out, said international relations professor Gregory Gause of the University of Vermont, Qatar's rulers made a decision. If we are going to play, we are going to be with the people on the rise, and that is the Islamists. Has betting on Islamists paid off? It's backfiring. Egypt's new military rulers recently accused Al Jazeera of supporting terrorism by airing interviews with Brotherhood supporters and shut down its offices in Cairo and began jamming its signals. The Emirates' support for Islamist militias has also angered Libya's interim government. When Sheikh Hamad stepped down this summer in favor of his son Tamim, the new emir called for an end to arrogant policies, an indication he might scale back his father's attempts to exert influence abroad. For years, Qatar has been punching above its weight, said Simon Henderson, a Middle East expert at the Washington Institute. Now, some may just try punching back. Qatar's weighty problem. The Emirate isn't just the world's richest country. It's also one of the fattest. Half of the adults and a third of the children are obese, and almost 17% of the native population suffers from diabetes. By comparison, about a third of Americans are obese and 8% diabetic. The problem is that Qataris are so rich that they don't need to work and have developed a taste for fatty American fast food. In Qatar, we just sit, smoke, and eat junk food, one resident told The Atlantic. Everything is done for us. The government has tried to battle the bloat by encouraging Qataris to eat less and exercise more. But the country's traditional culture makes it difficult for anyone to go on a diet. If you don't eat, it's considered a shame, one Qatari told the New York Times. And if you leave someone's home without eating, it's a shame. Take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from Dana Milbank at the Washington Post. The ongoing Benghazi circus. Why do people claim that the Benghazi scandal is phony? Asked Dana Milbank. To see why, just check with the conspiracy theorists who are now desperately trying to keep the scandal alive. At a conservative conference on Benghazi this week, Cliff Kincaid, the director of the conservative watchdog group Accuracy in Media, said the Obama administration was trying to cover up the fact that CIA operatives in Libya were secretly arming al-Qaeda terrorist groups. This administration has a policy of supporting al-Qaeda, the same people behind the death of nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11, Kincaid said. A former CIA officer, Claire Lopez, agreed that the administration had secretly decided to help the forces of Islam of al-Qaeda. Back on Earth, there are legitimate questions about whether the State Department could have prevented the deaths of four Americans in Benghazi. But that's not what interests Republican partisans. They'd rather swap nutty fantasies about President Obama's terrorist sympathies while searching for some way to damage Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential chances. Outside the fever swamps, no one is listening. The next column comes from Katrina Trinko at nationalreview.com. Don't waste food stamps on junk food. Food stamps should be used to ease hunger, not satisfy junk food cravings, said Katrina Trinko. For that very good reason, U.S. Representative Phil Rowe, Republican from Tennessee, has introduced a bill limiting food stamp purchases to nutritious food. Under current rules, food stamps cannot be used to buy alcohol, cigarettes, or prepared food. But you can buy sodas, cookies, candy, and ice cream. Recipients do buy a lot of this junk. Last year, they squandered $2 billion of taxpayer money on sugar-filled soda alone. Under Rowe's proposal, the federal food stamps program would adopt the same rules used in New York State's Women, Infants, and Children's Food Aid Program, which is designed to ensure that women and kids get proper nutrition. That program bans recipients from using their benefits to buy soda, sugary cereals like Fruit Loops, frozen French fries and tater tots, or canned fruit filled with added sugar. No one, mind you, is talking about banning junk food. Just ensuring that taxpayers aren't subsidizing poor choices that make people obese. If you can't use food stamps to buy cigarettes, you shouldn't be able to use them to buy gallons of Pepsi. And from Joshua Holland at Salon.com, why rural regions want to secede. Rural conservatives have reached a tipping point, said Joshua Holland. Fed up with the policies on gun control, gay marriage, immigration, and taxes being ushered in by urban liberal majorities, conservative activists in rural counties in Maryland, Colorado, Kansas, Nebraska, and Michigan are threatening to secede and form their own deep red states. These frustrated rebels have virtually no chance of succeeding, because the creation of new states would have to be approved by both their state legislatures and Congress. But when you consider the bubble many of these folks live in, their frustration starts to make sense. They get most or all of their information from right-wing media outlets like Fox News and talk radio or pandering politicians like Sarah Palin. Every day they are told they live in the real America, a fundamentally conservative country of white Christian gun owners. The people's will, they're told, is being thwarted by East Coast elites, pointy-headed academics, and the liberal media. So when real Americans lose elections and see their influence waning, the only logical conclusion is that democracy no longer works. Under such circumstances, seceding seems like a perfectly rational response. Take a look now at the last word section. We've got an article on conspiracy theories. Throughout our history, says Jesse Walker, Americans have been sure someone was plotting against us. On January 30th, 1835, as Andrew Jackson exited a congressman's funeral, an assassin drew a weapon and pointed it at the president. The pistol misfired. The gunman pulled a second weapon. Though loaded, it too failed to fire. The cane-wielding Jackson and several bystanders subdued the would-be killer, an unemployed house painter named Richard Lawrence. Lawrence later informed interrogators that he was King Richard III and that Jackson had killed his father. He was judged insane and committed to an asylum. Lawrence was a lone nut. Or at least that was the official story. It wasn't long before two witnesses filed affidavits claiming to have seen Lawrence at the home of Mississippi Senator George Poindexter shortly before the attack. Poindexter was an opponent of the Jackson administration, and pro-Jackson newspapers accused the senator of plotting the president's murder. Some of Jackson's critics countered by suggesting that the president had staged the assault to gain public support, and this explained why both weapons had failed. And many Jacksonians pointed their finger at Senator John Calhoun of South Carolina. When the Republican writer John Smith Dye described the crime 29 years later, he saw an even more devilish plot at work. Calhoun might not have been directly involved in the assault, Dye conceded, but Dye believed that Calhoun had been a part of a larger force, the slave power, that would have benefited if Jackson had been put in the ground. And he was convinced the slave power had assassinated two more U.S. presidents, William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor, and that another, James Buchanan, had narrowly escaped death at their hands. Assassination theorists weren't the only Americans worried about conspiracies of slaveholders. Dye didn't coin the phrase slave power. The term was common currency in the North, where it was used to describe the political influence of the planter elite. This was not in itself a conspiracy theory, but it often adopted a conspiratorial coloring. In the words of the historian Russell B. Nye, the slave power had an alleged agenda to extend slavery to the territories and free states, possibly to whites, and to destroy civil liberties, control the policies of the federal government, and complete the formation of a nationwide ruling aristocracy based on a slave economy. Meanwhile, Southerners had elaborate conspiracy theories of their own, blaming slave revolts, both real and imagined, on the machinations of rebellion-stoking abolitionists, treacherous land pirates, and other outside agitators. It was a paranoid time. In America, it is always a paranoid time. The fear of conspiracies has been a potent force across the political spectrum, from the colonial era to the present, in the establishment as well as at the extremes. Conspiracy theories played major roles in conflicts from the Indian Wars of the 17th century to the labor battles of the Gilded Age, from the American Revolution to the War on Terror. Unfortunately, much of the public perception of political paranoia seems frozen in 1964, when the historian Richard Hofstadter published The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Hofstadter set out to describe a style of mind marked by heated exaggeration, suspiciousness, and conspiratorial fantasy. Detecting it in movements ranging from the anti-Masonic in anti-Catholic crusades of the 19th century, to the popular left-wing press, and contemporary right-wing of his time. The essay does contain some real insights, and if nothing else, it can remind readers that conspiracy theories are not a recent invention. But it also declares that political paranoia is the preferred style only of minority movements. Hofstadter did not provide numbers to back up that conclusion. We do have some data on the popularity of well-known conspiracy theories, though, and the results do not support his sweeping claim. In 2006, a nationwide survey indicated that 36% of people polled, a minority but hardly a modest one, believed it very or somewhat likely that U.S. leaders had either allowed 9/11 to happen or actively plotted the attacks. Theories about JFK's assassination aren't a minority taste at all. 40 years after John F. Kennedy was shot, an ABC News poll showed 70% of the country believing a conspiracy was behind the president's death. Educated elites have conspiracy theories, too. By that, I do not mean that members of the establishment sometimes embrace a disreputable theory, though that does happen. I mean something far broader. The center sometimes embraces ideas that are no less paranoid than the views of the fringe. Consider the phenomenon of the moral panic, a time when fear and hysteria are magnified, distorted, and perhaps even created by influential social institutions. The sociologist Stanley Cohen sketched in the standard progression of a moral panic in 1972. A condition, episode, person, or group of persons emerges to become defined as a threat to societal values and interest. Its nature is presented in a stylized and stereotypical fashion by the mass media. The moral barricades are manned by editors, bishops, politicians, and other right-thinking people. Socially accredited experts pronounce their diagnoses and solutions. Ways of coping are evolved or, more often, resorted to. The condition then disappears, submerges, or deteriorates and becomes more visible. An essential feature of a moral panic is a folk devil, typically a scapegoat who is not, in fact, responsible for the threat. The folk devil often takes the form of a conspiracy, a satanic cult, a powerful gang, a backwoods militia. Cohen's case study is British, but there are American equivalents. One is the anti-prostitution panic of the early 20th century, which featured lurid tales of a vast international white slavery syndicate conscripting thousands of innocent girls each year into sexual service. A former Chicago prosecutor claimed that the syndicate amounted to an invisible government, a hidden hand, and a secret power. Coerced prostitution really did exist, but it was neither as prevalent nor as organized as the era's wild rhetoric suggested. Yet far from being consigned to a marginal minority movement, the scare led to a major piece of national legislation, the Mann Act of 1910. And gave the first major boost in power to the agency that would later be known as the FBI. Within a decade, the Bureau would be extending its purview from alleged conspiracies of pimps to alleged conspiracies of communists, getting another boost in power in the process. Such stories are missing from Hofstadter's account. The result was a distorted picture in which the country's outsiders are possessed by fear and its establishment usually is not. The essay had room for greenback and populist writers who constructed a great conspiracy of international bankers, but it said nothing about the elites of the era who perceived populism as the product of a conspiracy. When scholars and pundits aren't claiming that paranoia is limited to the political extremes, they sometimes claim that it's a product of a particularly harsh times. In 2009, the conservative writer David Frum offered that explanation for the popularity of Glenn Beck, a right-wing broadcaster with a fondness for conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories, Frum wrote, always flourish during economic downturns. He's right. They do flourish during economic downturns, but they also flourish during economic upturns. Frum was attacking Beck for his interest in the idea that the Federal Emergency Management Agency was building secret concentration camps. So it's worth noting that the very same fear was popular on the left during the booming 80s and on the right during the booming 90s. For the last few decades, elements of whatever party is out of power have worried that the party in power would turn fascist. Beck eventually rejected the FEMA story. Even if you set aside purely partisan fears, the 1990s, a time of relative peace and prosperity, were also a golden age of both frankly fictional and allegedly true tales of conspiracy. There are many reasons for this, including the not unsubstantial fact that even at its most peaceful, the United States is riven with conflicts. But there is also the possibility that peace breeds nightmares just as surely as strife does. The anthropologist David Graeber has argued that it's the most peaceful societies which are also the most haunted in their imaginative constructions of the cosmos by constant specters of perennial war. The Piaroa Indians of Venezuela, he wrote, are famous for their peaceableness, but they inhabit a cosmos of endless invisible war, in which wizards are engaged in fending off attacks of insane predatory gods, and all deaths are caused by spiritual murder and have to be avenged by the magical massacre of whole distant unknown communities. Many middle-class bloggers leading comfortable lives spend their spare time in a similar subterranean universe. On October 30, 1938, the CBS radio network transmitted The War of the Worlds. The broadcast, directed and narrated by Orson Welles, was based on H.G. Wells' famous novel about a Martian invasion of Earth. But the action was moved from Victorian England to contemporary New Jersey. It was and is a brilliant and effective drama. But the broadcast is famous today for reasons that go well beyond its artistic quality. You might think you know the story. In popular memory, hordes of listeners mistook the play for an actual alien invasion, setting off a mass panic. The truth was more mundane, but also more interesting. There were indeed listeners who, apparently missing the initial announcement that the story was fiction, took the show at face value and believed a real invasion was underway. But they did not appear to have been any more common than the people today who mistake satires in The Onion for a real newspaper reports. The mass panic was a myth. After the play aired, the prominent political commentator, Walter Lippmann, took the opportunity to warn against crowds that drift with all the winds that blow and are caught up at last in the great hurricanes, adding that those masses without roots and their volcanic and hysterical energy are the chaos in which the new Caesars are born. As media scholar Michael Sokolow put it, the legend of the Mars panic cemented a growing suspicion that skillful artists or incendiary demagogues could use communications technology to capture the consciousness of the nation. To capture consciousness, what a chilling image. It's an idea that appears when dissidents warn that our leaders are using mass media to brainwash us. But you can also find the fear among those leaders themselves, who have a long history of fretting over the influence of any new medium of communication. If Orson Welles was cast as a wizard with the power to cloud men's minds, his listeners were imagined as a mindless mob easily manipulated. The War of the Worlds story is usually told as a parable about popular hysteria, of a sudden spike in the sort of fear that Hofstadter's essay decried. But at least as much, it is a parable about elite hysteria, of the anti-populist anxiety that Hofstadter's essay exemplifies. No history of American paranoia can be complete unless it includes the latter. This article was taken from the book The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory by Jesse Walker. Back on the health and science page, a new way to keep older minds sharp. To stay mentally sharp, seniors may want to swap their crossword puzzles for a video game controller. New research at the University of California, San Francisco, found that learning to multitask in a fast-paced environment significantly improved the cognitive abilities of older adults. And the improvement was long-lasting. Researchers asked volunteers ages 60 to 85 to play a video game called NeuroRacer, designed to train them to multitask effectively. In the game, players are required to steer a car down a winding road. After a while, signs begin to pop up, and the volunteers have to identify them while continuing to drive. When the volunteers first played the game, their driving skills fell by 64% when the signs appeared. By comparison, people in their 20s saw only a 26% drop in performance. But after a month of playing the game three times a week, the older adults handled the appearance of the signs better than the untrained young people. What's more, they scored higher on tests of short-term memory and long-term focus after training than they had before. And brain scans showed they had an increased activity in regions linked to attention. I feel like my brain is working better, Ann Lindsley, 65, a participant in the study, told the Wall Street Journal. The study shows you can take older people who aren't functioning well and make them cognitively younger through this training, said Earl K. Miller, a neuroscientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's a very big deal. The healthiest fruit. All fruit isn't created equal when it comes to preventing diabetes. A Harvard University study that tracked the diets of more than 185,000 people over 12 years shows that eating strawberries, oranges, peaches, plums, and apricots has no impact on a person's likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes. But grapes, apples, grapefruit, and blueberries do help ward off the disease. Blueberries had the greatest effect on diabetes risk. Eating between 1 and 3 servings a month decreased risk by 11%. Eating 5 servings a week decreased it by 26%. But the benefits of certain fruits don't extend to juices made from those fruits. The study found that drinking a single serving of juice per day increases the risk of diabetes by 21%. During the juicing process, some phytochemicals and dietary fiber are lost, study author Ki Sun tells NationalGeographic.com. The phytochemicals include antioxidants that may help the body break down glucose, while fiber slows absorption of the sugars. Many juices also contain added sugars, which can promote diabetic changes in the body. Health scare of the week: the perils of e-cigarettes. The number of middle and high school students in the U.S. who have tried electronic cigarettes has doubled within a year. Nearly 2 million teens now report that they've experimented with the devices, which use water vapor to deliver nicotine to the lungs and bloodstream. The increased use of e-cigarettes by teens is deeply troubling, Thomas Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, tells the Washington Post. Nicotine is a highly addictive drug. E-cigarette makers contend the devices are safer than traditional cigarettes because they don't burn tobacco and therefore don't produce tar or carbon monoxide. But the devices hook teens on nicotine and thus may encourage them to try traditional cigarettes. 3 out of 4 teens who said they'd tried e-cigarettes had tried traditional cigarettes too. Anti-smoking advocates say e-cigarette companies are marketing directly to kids by offering flavors like cherry, strawberry, and cookies and cream, potentially setting them up for a lifetime of nicotine addiction. From the Talking Points section, 5 years later, how the Great Recession changed America. 5 years after the U.S. economy imploded, said Robert Reich in HuffingtonPost.com, the gambling addiction of Wall Street's biggest banks is more dangerous than ever. It was 5 years ago this week that Lehman Brothers went bankrupt after losing several billion-dollar bets on derivatives tied to home mortgages, sending the economy into a tailspin and ushering in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. The government bailout of Wall Street's too-big-to-fail giants prevented the recession from turning into a depression. But 5 years on, they're back to too many of their old habits. J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, last year blew $6.2 billion by betting on the credit default swaps that got the banking sector into trouble in the 2000s, and has been accused of fraud in collecting credit card debt and foreclosing on mortgages. The Dodd-Frank legislation passed by Congress in 2010 was supposed to prevent these kinds of abuses, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. But Wall Street's army of lobbyists has ensured that the law's new regulations to promote transparency and limit high-risk trades are shot through with loopholes. Far from getting smaller, America's six largest banks now have 28% more assets than in 2007. The banks are bigger and still dangerously underregulated, and if they failed, would require another massive government bailout. Have we learned nothing at all? Actually, Wall Street has improved enormously since 2008, said Kevin Roos in nymag.com. The big banks are much better capitalized than they were before the crash, meaning they have more assets to cushion them from unexpected losses. Most financial institutions took a beating during the crash, and the devil-may-care attitude that once ruled Wall Street has largely disappeared, with banks holding smaller portfolios and avoiding the massive risks that sank them in 2008. When two banks tried to package and sell a synthetic CDO this year, the type of derivative that caused AIG's collapse, nobody wanted to buy. And while it's true that Dodd-Frank legislation is being watered down by lobbying, regulators have stiffer backbones and are winning at least some of the battles. Wall Street is far from perfect, but it's a lot less of a threat to American prosperity than it was 5 years ago. What prosperity? Said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. The financial industry may have come roaring back in recent years, but middle-class Americans have not recovered from the staggering blows of the Great Recession, which economists estimate cost the country $14 trillion in lost economic output. Most Americans are still living in a diminished economy, with high unemployment and flat wages. And the trend of income inequality that began in the 2000s has only accelerated. A new study by Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez found that the richest 1% of the country reaped 95% of the recovery's gains since 2009, with their incomes growing by 31%. Inequality of such magnitude is poisoning our society, making a mockery of the American dream of equal opportunity. This cannot long stand, said Charles M. Blow, also in the Times. The Occupy Wall Street movement, which began 2 years ago this week, introduced the idea of the 99%, a struggling underclass dominated by 1% of wealthy plutocrats. It's a narrative that has outlived the protest and embedded itself in the national conscience. Anger is growing. If the country's leaders don't start coming up with some solutions, eventually the 99% will demand better. But blaming the 1% is too easy, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. 5 years ago, we all became victims of success. Decades of near-perpetual prosperity fooled everyone, on Wall Street and Main Street alike, into thinking that America had found the secret to endless economic growth. Bankers made increasingly risky bets on the market, while consumers made equally risky investments in real estate and took on way too much debt. We believed that home prices and markets would keep rising forever, and were shocked when they collapsed. Today, the foolish optimism of 2008 has become the protective pessimism of 2013. Companies and consumers are now reluctant to borrow, spend, lend, hire, or take economic risk of any kind. As a result, our once dynamic economy has stagnated. 5 years later, the real problem is not that Wall Street hasn't changed enough. It's that the rest of us have changed too much. And we wind down with a few short notes. The U.S. teen birth rate dropped 6% between 2011 and 2012, and is now the lowest it's been in the 73 years the government has been tracking it. Health experts attribute the decline to sex education and the increased availability of contraception. On game day, Cowboy Stadium consumes more electricity with its air conditioning, massive scoreboard, and other power-sucking amenities than Liberia, a nation of 3.7 million people. And a quote here from Alice Walker, quoted in the Monterey County, California Herald. The long-term accommodation that protects marriage and other such relationships is forgetfulness. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.